I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A New York Times op-ed titled "When Politicians Determine Religious Beliefs" caught our eye recently. That thesis turned some conventional wisdom on its head that our religious beliefs affect our politics. After all, evangelicals are more likely to vote Republican than Democrat. It's been called the God Gap. Michelle Margolis, the author of that op-ed, writes in her new book, From Politics to the Pews, that for many people, their politics shapes their religious beliefs. Quote, "We don't just take cues about politics from our pastors and priests. We take cues about religion from our politicians." She found, broadly speaking, that Democrats and Republicans in their 20s were equally secular, having distanced themselves from their religion while in high school. This was also a time when they built their political identities and affiliations. A decade later, Republicans were more likely to go back to church than Democrats. Today, we explore that intersection between religion and politics, especially in these deeply polarized times. Michelle Margolis is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Michelle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to talk about religion and politics. It doesn't get better than that. Let me give out that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-7-9-4-9-9, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Why does it matter, this kind of chicken egg question about religion and politics? Why does it matter, in a sense, which comes first?
I think it matters, you know, for a lot of reasons. I guess the first is there's so much written about and we think about how religion influences our politics, whether it can mobilize you to go to the polls, whether it can mobilize you to go to a pro-life march, whatever the action is. We think that it's religion doing the action. But what does it mean if we've self-selected into or out of religion? It means that we've created political echo chambers in these worlds that are supposed to be apolitical or historically have been, you know, kind of a little bit separate, especially in the United States, from the political system. And so thinking about what it means if you're going to church on Sunday and sitting around and only talking about things with people who look and act politically like you. And so it means that changes the nature of religion based on politics. And it also changes the nature of politics, because if you're in a pew with a whole bunch of people who look and act like you, it's going to be very easy to get you mobilized. You're not hearing cross-pressured messages. You're not being confused by hearing Democratic and Republican ideas. You're getting one set of ideas. Those match with your views. And so it makes sense that it looks like religion is really important and it's this important driver in politics.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and let's take a kind of a generic person. I think many people would say that they grew up in a family that was either religious or not religious, or a particular religion, or no religion whatsoever, and some kind of party affiliation, that their families that identify, you know, we've always voted Republican, we've always voted Democrat. Do you think that's true? Do you think that's even true today?
Yeah, I think it's true today. But I think what's really important is that people who are raised with religion, not everyone, but a very common thing that happens is in adolescence and young adulthood, people just become less religious. It's just not a priority for them. And sociologists have noted that this happens across the board. It's not specific to one particular religion. And in fact, the fallaway is often steeper among those who are raised in more devout households. So being raised in a specific tradition or being raised in a really religious household, that's not going to curb the tide away. It's not going to stem the tide. Many people fall away from religion. It's just not important. And
because I guess in many ways one is questioning one's belief system, one's family, one's lineage, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, it happens for a lot of reasons. So as you said, questioning things. Part of it is asserting independence, right? You just want to separate yourself from your parents. You don't necessarily want to be doing what you're doing, what they're doing automatically. And some of it is just much more passive, right? Whether or not you go away, you might go away to college, you might enter the workforce, but whatever it is, your institutions, your social ties are being torn apart at that time, right? When you're a young adult, all of a sudden you go off to college and you have to find a new church to go to, or you start working and maybe you work on Sunday, and if you want to keep going to church, you need to find another time or another place to go. And so a lot of it is Some people fall away because they're actively taking a stand or actively questioning their beliefs. And some people, it's just like it happens. Mm-hmm. There's just other things going on in your life at that time.
You also say that this time, and I guess we should talk about it as adolescence and early adulthood. So questioning some of these religious beliefs, and obviously we're speaking very broadly here, but also is that when people begin to think about a political identity, they have a chance to vote, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. So then the political scientists have long shown that our political identities are really formed in this adolescence and young adulthood period. And then the identity that we form then, not that we can't change our political identities, but they're quite stable. We don't flip-flop between the Democratic and Republican parties much over our life. And that whole adage of if you're not a bleeding heart liberal at 20, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative when you're 40, you have no brain. That we don't actually have empirical evidence of that. For the most part, the identities that you form in young adulthood and your political views on kind of key issues and your key political outlooks remain pretty stable over the course of your life.
I'm curious because I think this, in many ways, what we're talking about is objective, but it's also subjective. What people define as their religious beliefs or whether they are a religious person or not. Even political beliefs. There are very progressive Democrats and they're more conservative Democrats and to some degree with the Republicans as well.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. And so my research focuses on individuals' own interpretations of things. So they're telling me what they think their views are. I'm not assuming anything because I think that's absolutely right. It's completely subjective. Mm-hmm. And you hear lots of people who say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, or I'm deeply personally religious, but I never go to church. And so the fact that there's so many ways people can think about religion and be religious or non-religious, particularly in a place like the United States where we have so many ways that you can practice religion, and there's so many options that people can and do have these kind of what might seem like inconsistent mm-hmm. behaviors and beliefs, but they're mm-hmm. actually very internally consistent for the person.
Because they believe them. It fits their belief system. What you found was that, so you've got this period where young people are questioning and searching. Let's see if I get this right. The ones that end up returning to the Republican Party, they're the ones that have kind of embraced religion more than the ones who return to the Democratic Party? Or do I have that upside down?
So it's the reverse. So okay. The people who are Republicans when they're young adults are much more likely to return to religion, right? So an important thing is so people fall away from religion, and some stay away from religion, but getting married and having kids is a really important time when people make decisions about their religious beliefs and behaviors. Because now all of a sudden you have to decide, how do I want to raise my kids? Do I want them going? What kind of church do I want to go to? Do I want my child baptized? Do I want them going to Sunday school? And when you make those decisions, you already have your partisanship. And that's exactly when the partisanship comes into play.
So what you have then is, or what we have ended up with, is a Republican Party that tends to skew more Christian and conservative. And it looks like a Democratic Party that's kind of a mixed bag of various religious beliefs.
Absolutely, yeah. It's important to say I think people, it's easy to paint the Republican Party as religious and the Democratic Party as non-religious, and that is definitively not the case. There are definitely secular Republicans, but there's also many religious Democrats. And then there's also Democrats who are religious of non-Christian faiths as well. But again, speaking very broadly, if you were to tell me you were a weekly churchgoer of any Christian or Catholic faith and you said $5 if you guess my party, I would guess Republican. And if you told me I am non-religious or I am a non-identifier, sometimes called a nun, but an N-O-N-E.
Yes, N-O-N-E.
Not a N-U-N. And you said I'm a non-identifier, $5, I would put you as a Democrat. So again, it doesn't mean you can't be one or the other, but statistically speaking, odds are that's where you would end up.
Except if you're African-American.
Except if you're African-American.
Let's talk about
that. Yes. So I spent a lot of time in my book talking about African-Americans. So for those of you listening who know stuff about religion and politics, it's that African-Americans are the most religiously devout racial or ethnic group. So Black Protestants are more religious than white evangelicals on any dimension, whether it's believing biblical literalism, frequency of prayer, frequency of going to church, more religious. But we also know that Democrats are the strongest Democrat, sorry, African Americans are the strongest Democratic bloc. And so that is very different than everything we just talked about and everything related to the God gap or the church attendance gap. Everything that we talk about every election cycle is about white folks. And the African Americans, it's a very different story. I'm happy to go into that.
Let me put something else out here, because you not only do you look at this life cycle, you also go back a couple of decades, back to the 1970s, and Democrats and Republicans were equally religious, or self-described as equally religious. They believed in God. They went to church. What has happened in the last couple of decades?
Yeah, so much has happened. So the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was no God gap. There was a gap where Catholics were more likely to be Democrats, and Protestants, depending on whether you lived in the North or South, were more likely to be Republicans. But this God gap is specifically related to your religiosity, that is, how religious you are, how frequently you go to church. And the gap that emerged in the 70s through today, it means that religious Catholics and mainline Protestants and evangelical Protestants are all more likely to be Republicans than their less religious counterparts. So it's created this umbrella of religious Americans that's distinct from the denominational gap. And so much happened in this intervening period, right? So first we have new policy issues that just didn't exist before, right? So there weren't debates.
Abortion. Women's rights.
Gay rights. All of that. We also have religious elites entering the political sphere, right? In the mid-1960s, you have Jerry Falwell saying, I'm not going to get involved in politics. That takes away time from saving souls. I am a pastor. My job is to save souls. But we all know that Jerry Falwell ended up founding the Moral Majority and was very politically consequential for many decades. And so you have religious elites entering the political sphere, reaching out to religious Americans. And you also have political elites reaching out to religious voters, right? So just thinking about 1960, you have John Kennedy saying, separation of church and state. I am the Democratic candidate for president. I happen to be a Catholic. Now you have.
And I don't have allegiance to the Pope.
And I don't have allegiance. Exactly. Whereas now you have politicians talking about their faith all the time and how their faith will influence their governing, their policies. And that started largely with Reagan and has moved on. And Democrats do this as well, but the Republicans do it much more so. And then the other big thing that happened is we said a moment ago that abortion became a salient issue. But the thing that many people forget is that the parties were divided on abortion, that in the 1970s, the Democrats and Republicans both had in their platforms things that basically said, this is a messy thing, and that there are people in both parties who are both pro-life and pro-choice, or support keeping Roe v. Wade versus overturning it. But by 1980, that's when the party started to diverge on that, and that the pro-life rhetoric got taken out of the Democratic platform, the pro-choice rhetoric got taken out of the Republican platform. And by 1984, not only was it a very pro-life Republican platform, but they were also using religious rhetoric to justify the position. So not only has abortion become divided along the parties that didn't exist before, but now it's also become this religious issue.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michelle Margolis, and she's got a new book, From Politics to the Pews, How Partisanship and Political Environment Shape Religious Identity. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Michelle Margolis. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. We've been talking about this intersection, this interplay between religion and politics, especially in these deeply polarized times. Let me pick up. You've been helping us sort of go through some history, and we've gotten up to 1984, where you begin to see what appears as if there's a kind of a sorting between the two mainstream parties and some of these intensely held religious beliefs, especially espoused by conservatives. Is it because of Reagan, and is it because of Falwell and Reagan beginning to recognize each other?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part of it. I mean, I would be hesitant to say that any one thing caused this to happen, right? But just so much happened in the 1970s and 80s that basically, before the 1970s, no difference between the parties and how they talked about religion. There was no religious elites weren't active in the political sphere. There weren't really hot button political issues that tied into religion and politics as neatly as they do today. And all of those changes, all of a sudden, now voters can choose, and based on their religiosity, how they view the political world. Or this is where my argument comes in, that that's at a time where now all of a sudden they're going to draw on their politics when making religious decisions. And so I would be hesitant to say that all of that, what happened, but a lot happened in that time.
Indeed. And you mentioned the fact that for African Americans, who are the most religious people in this country and also tend to vote Democrat by huge percentages, that is an exception to this rule that we've been talking about. Is there an explanation?
Yeah. So the explanation I find in my book is that right, a core reason why all of this is happening is something called cognitive dissonance, which is that we as people don't like to feel conflicted about things. If you are very liberal and democratic, you don't want to go hear messages that don't mesh with those views, and vice versa. And so all of this is about not facing cognitive dissonance, minimizing that cognitive dissonance. So you would say, well, how could African Americans be very religious and being very democratic? They should have all this cognitive dissonance. And the answer is, we live in a highly segregated society when it comes to religion. And most African Americans go to black churches. Black churches, the theology is different than many white religious churches. And they actually, it skews much more democratic, as far as it focuses on equality and justice and economic issues that would lead you to being a Democrat. So a religious black Democrat going to church wouldn't hear messages that made them feel uncomfortable voting Democratic. And the Democratic part, the black church, more than any other church, there's so much political mobilization that goes on in the churches for the Democratic Party. This stems from the civil rights movement, but great work by Bob Putnam and Dave Campbell show that for all the politicking we think that goes on in white evangelical churches, it's way more prevalent in black churches, but it's happening on the Democratic side. And you have Democratic politicians coming to black churches to campaign. All of these things make it completely compatible for an African-American to say, I'm very religious. I deeply believe the teachings of the Bible, but the teachings of the Bible that are emphasized are things that are going to push you toward the Democratic Party. I'm hearing voter mobilization messages and visits from candidates that are Democratic. So there's none of this cognitive dissonance that a white person, a white Democrat who might go to a very conservative church, might feel.
Let me read some comments. An email from John. He says, one image that sticks with me is from the documentary Jesus Camp, where a bunch of evangelicals were weeping while touching a cardboard cutout of George W. Bush. Was this a new level of a religious idol worship being applied to an American politician? And in fact, you write in your book that there was, if not a turning point, some central moments, I guess, within the George W. Bush administration first term that seemed to be a dividing or turning point.
Yeah, so it does seem like with George W. Bush, I think it actually started with Reagan. I think he was the first person where that linkage was there. And H.W. Bush actually didn't talk about politics all that much. And then we were left with W. Bush, Methodist, but calls himself an evangelical, talked openly about his faith, was really committed to bringing faith into the political arena. And I think that resonated a lot with conservative evangelicals. I think what's interesting about the W. Bush stuff is that he was actually criticized far more by some of these folks, the people in Jesus Camp, than, say, Donald Trump is today. So despite that connection, I think it's become even stronger. If the turning point was earlier, we've maybe reached the peak of it potentially now.
And I do want to talk about present day. A couple of more questions. One from Melanie. Has your guest addressed Jews and the political position? Have you looked at that?
Yeah. So it was actually Jews was a motivating factor in looking into this. It's really hard to do research on Jewish Americans by virtue of the small numbers. So I would have loved to spend more time digging into that. That is a very difficult group to look into. It does seem like this happens, but maybe less in the religiosity phase and much more in the choosing your denominations. So, right, you can be a conservative, Reconstructionist, Reform, Orthodox. And while conservative Jews are still overwhelmingly Democratic, it is a more conservative environment than, say, a Reform synagogue. And that has to do with politics. It also has to do with egalitarianism. And so I think that they're, my experience talking with Jews, again, because I couldn't do systematic survey research easily, seems to be that their politics is really shaping which denomination they're selecting into. Am I going to go to a conservative synagogue or a Reform synagogue? And that might be a matter of your views on Israel. It might be your views on egalitarianism. It might be something like that. But
again, sort of politics coming first and then religion coming second.
It can be, yeah. I mean, I think the one another asterisk that we should put by some of these results is that it's important, I think, with Christianity and to a lesser extent Catholicism, those are the mainstream, that is what America is associated with. When you get into minority religions like Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, there's also a cultural attachment that is very different, that keeps people in the faith, even nominally, more so than a Christian might just say, oh, I'm nothing. Many Jews who are non-practicing still retain the identification because of the non-religious aspects of it, right?
Yeah, complicated stuff. Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Colin: would love to hear the guest thoughts on why religiosity and political leanings are both to some degree heritable. And we touched on this earlier, which is I do think we largely grow up in families that identify themselves politically and religiously.
Yeah, so both are heritable, but to varying degrees, right? And so I think a big and a very important thing to remember is that I don't know if anyone listening does, most people do not practice their faith exactly how they were raised, right? And so you might be inheriting certain ideas or concepts, but at the end of the day, you're going to pick and choose your faith and your community based on what suits your needs. And the same thing with politics. Politics, particularly partisanship, is many people have the party ID of their parents. It's not quite as strong as one might expect, in part because a lot of people don't always talk about politics and they misremember. So what you actually find is the rate of parent-child sharing a party ID is far lower if you actually ask both of them their party IDs than if you ask someone, what's your party ID and what's your mom's party ID? You're going to attribute, you're going to maybe be mistaken and you're going to give your mom your party ID. And so depending on the survey, the level of heritability looks a little different.
That's so interesting. I mean, the idea of not wanting this cognitive dissonance, I guess, even within the family. Let me read an email from Mark who said, there are many of us who do not fit the stereotypical categories. I have leaned Democrat since I was 15. I've also been since about the same time an evangelical Christian who loves Jesus. For people like me, it's been deeply distressing to see the evangelical church embrace Trumpism. And I'm sure Mark is not alone, and this just, I think, underscores the complexity of what we're talking about.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is very tricky. So I just came back from 6 weeks of fieldwork in Alabama, and I definitely spoke with evangelical Democrats who have very well worked out thoughts on their politics and very well worked out thoughts on their faith. And they are also very concerned about what is going on. And the question is, what are they going to do about it? And one answer is that they're thinking about dropping the label, right? They're
Which
dropping
one?
The label evangelical, sorry.
Evangelical.
That doesn't change the beliefs they have, but if the it doesn't change the beliefs they have, but if the evangelical label seems to have become politically tainted, so to speak, that's they've opted to call themselves a Bible-believing Christian, or, you know, they've adopted new language to account for the fact that saying you're an evangelical Christian means something political that they don't want to be associated with.
Let me play a clip. Let me actually just reintroduce you quickly. That's Michelle Margolis. And again, we're talking about her new book, From Politics to the Pews. And it's about the influence of politics and religion on each other and how we define them for ourselves. 1-888-477-9499. The number to join our conversation. Also, radiotimes@whyy.org. That's our email address. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. 81% of white evangelicals voted for President Trump. Let me play Jerry Falwell Jr., president of Liberty University, appearing on CNN, and this was in January.
What the press misunderstands about evangelicals so often is that our whole faith is based, now I'm not a pastor, I'm an attorney, I was a commercial real estate developer before I became a college president,
right.
But what they don't understand about evangelicals is our whole faith is based on the theology of forgiveness, of the, on the fact that we believe Jesus taught also that all of us are sinners. We all sin every day. And that's why evangelicals supported Trump so strongly, because that's their theology. And he supported the policies that they thought were important, protecting the borders, cutting taxes, all the appointing the Supreme Court justices that are strict constructionists, all those things, just like the average men and women. And so I just don't think it's fair to look at evangelicals as a bunch of judgmental moralists when Jesus said, judge not, lest you be judged.
What I found so fascinating about that, Michelle, is this notion of forgiveness and tax cuts in the same answer to the question. Help us understand the white evangelical support for our president.
Yeah, so I think I never heard that clip before, but Falwell is saying something that is not new, right? So the Christian Coalition and the Moral Majority would have pamphlets rating the candidates, but not just on abortion, on the Panama Canal Treaty. You know, so in the same way, it's like, didn't know where in the New Testament they talk about the Panama Canal Treaty. But it just links, it says something about how linked religion and politics are, or conservative religion and conservative politics, that, you know, how we interpret the Constitution, taxes, borders, those are justifications for forgiving someone who said that he's never asked for forgiveness.
Well, I was going to say, don't you need to, I'm no religious scholar here, but don't you need to ask for forgiveness in order to be able to receive it?
My understanding is yes. I'm a political scientist who studies religion. I'm also not an expert in religion, but my understanding is you do have to ask for forgiveness to receive it. But I think that it's really important, and it shows the kinds of mental gymnastics that people will go through to be okay with their political guy. And one thing I do want to just say very clearly is that this is a time where religious evangelicals supporting Trump might show some hypocrisy on their part. They're not the only group that does that. We know many feminists were silent or complicit in things that Democratic politicians did that were not wonderful for women, and whether it was sexual assault or harassment. So it's important to know that this kind of behavior happens across the board. But right now we're living in a time where, yes, white evangelicals are able to justify through biblical means how they're able to support their political guy who supports their views on borders and the Constitution and taxes.
So hypocrisy can be bipartisan.
Yes, that's the only bipartisan thing we have left.
Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. It does also sort of get back to, again, how one defines or describes one's belief system. There's that, you know, cliche, well, what would Jesus do? Or what would Jesus believe? Is Jesus a Republican? Is Jesus a Democrat? Is that helpful?
It's helpful as a way to justify your political views religiously. I mean, what's amazing about biblical literalism or the Bible in general is it is a huge book, right? You have a vengeful God. You have a very forgiving God. You have a God that supports open borders. You have a God that respects rule of law. So regardless of what you want to believe politically, there is biblical justification for it. And so I think saying what would Jesus do is, in a political world, gives you a lot of options. And makes it very easy to not have the cognitive dissonance that we were talking about before.
Let me read some more comments. One from Warren: is the Black Baptist religious group a large voting bloc? Does it compare to the TV fundamentalist mega church right wing group? I mean, these are in many ways very politically active groups within our country.
Right. So religious African American voters vote at a disproportionately high rate based on their socioeconomic status. They make up a smaller group than conservative white evangelicals as a block. So if you look at the numbers of people going to the polls who call themselves, say, let's just to make it easy, a white evangelical versus a black evangelical, there are far more white evangelicals. There's also more there's more breakaway. So if 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump, that means 19% didn't.
Right.
But for, you know, black evangelicals, that number is in the 90s voting for the Democratic. So it's even a tighter coalition, even though it is a smaller number.
a tweet from Teo: as the current political climate proves, religion and politics shouldn't intersect. Religion is just another tool to manipulate voters to vote for a particular political interest, not any different from money. Do you share that? I mean, these things can be used as political tools. There's no question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very it's a not a positive, warm, fuzzy statement, but I don't wholly disagree with it. It is a very successful mobilizing strategy, and that's why politicians have been using it, because it works. It is easy to appeal when you can call people the good guys or the bad guys or the people who are on the side of God and not. That's a really powerful tactic.
You were in Alabama, as you said, doing research, knocking on doors, talking to people about their faith, their politics?
Pretty close. So I was interviewing with a lot of pastors, but I was actually spending a lot of time in a fast food restaurant called Jack's. They're all over the state. It's like McDonald's, but Jack's. And it's a type of place where just an Alabama politician will say, I want to get the Jack's voter. It's the type of people who go every day for breakfast, every day for lunch. So I would be at Jack's all over the state, wow, just asking to talk to people. And so I met very religious people. I met non-religious people across the board, talking to them about their faith, talking to them about how their faith informs their politics, how their politics might inform their faith. The one big takeaway that I learned was that no one really knows what an evangelical is.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I'm curious about what your takeaway was. Or
There was a couple, but one major one was I was just asking people the survey question of, do you consider yourself an evangelical or born-again Christian? That's the question on exit polls. That's where the 81% statistic comes from. And people will give answers, but it was amazing because people would say, well, I'm born again, but not an evangelical, or I'm one, but not the other. But then you ask them, what do those terms mean? And you have two people saying, I'm a born again, but not an evangelical. One person saying, well, evangelicals are far more religious. I'm a born again, I'm less religious. And then you have other people, another person saying, I'm a born again because I'm truly devout and the evangelicals aren't. So the idea that there really was a limited agreement on what it even means to be an evangelical, you know, pops into
my head. America, don't you think?
That's America. It also raises, you know, every time I read a newspaper article about white evangelicals, I don't even know what to make of it anymore.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Michelle Margolis about politics and religion. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guest about religion and politics, how one often shapes the other. And she is Michelle Margolis. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She's got a new book called From Politics to the Pews. I played a couple of minutes ago Jerry Falwell Jr. talking about the support of white evangelical Christians for President Trump. This is President Trump speaking at the Celebrate Freedom Concert, July 1st, 2017.
And above all else, we know this. In America, we don't worship government, we worship God. We don't want to see God forced out of the public square, driven out of our schools, or pushed out of our civic life. We want to see prayers before football games if they want to give prayers. We want all children to have the opportunity to know the blessings of God. We will not allow the government to censor sermons, to restrict the free speech of our pastors and our preachers and the people that we most respect.
Much to pick up there. I mean, it just shows you how political religion is, how religion and politics are just so intertwined.
Absolutely. I mean, he tapped into a lot of things right there, right? So things with prayer in school and prayer in civic life. I mean, that all goes back to the 1960s with Supreme Court rulings that decided this. That wasn't done by the president or the legislature. That was Supreme Court rulings. But that does seem like it's something that really resonated. I talked to a lot of people in Alabama, And no matter what the issue was, we would talk about school shootings, everything. What's to be done about this? These are NRA people who are very worried about school shootings, but taking away guns isn't the answer. And it always comes back to, once we took religion out of schools, once we stopped praying in schools, once religion came out of civic life, that started us on a moral decline as a country. So that's something that really probably resonated with a lot of the people listening. And the Johnson Amendment, which is the idea that pastors can't endorse or talk about politics. One of Trump's minor platforms is to get rid of that.
That's right.
The pastors I spoke to don't support that, for what that's worth. They walk a very fine line. They don't want to alienate people based on political persuasions, and don't want to be put into a position where they feel like they have to take a political stand. And so that seems to be a very divisive platform, even within the religious community that supports Trump.
That's so interesting, because I also feel like it does happen where people in standing in pulpits are, if not telling people how to vote, using perhaps coded language mm-hmm. that would, in a sense, send the same message.
Absolutely. I learned something on the fly while I was in Alabama, which is, if I'm talking to a pastor, I say, how often do you talk about politics? And they say, well, never. I never talk about politics. I might say, tell people to go out to vote, but I would never talk about politics or tell them how to vote. And then I thought that was sort of weird. And then I started following up. It's, do you preach about abortion? Yes. Do I preach about LGBT issues or transgender issues? Yes, all the time. But those aren't political. Those are religious. You know, so I learned I had to change the question, that they're preaching about politics all the time because abortion and LGBT issues, those are political, but they are religious as well. And so to the extent that they say, we never say how to vote, but we are telling you all these issues and what the Bible says that are super important, and then I'm telling you to go vote.
Let me read some more comments and we'll get some callers in as well. A question from Monica. Is there any information about independents? And we've been talking as if we've got these two fixed polls. You've got Republicans and Democrats. But there's a lot of churn, a lot of people who have left parties, who call themselves, I guess, the political version of nuns, N-O-N-E-S. How do you see independents fitting into
yes.
this discussion?
So there's two interesting things about political independence. The first is that a lot of times when scholars or the pollsters ask people their partisanship, and they'll say independent. But then you say, do you lean one way or another? And most people lean, and those leaners act like partisans. Maybe they don't want to call themselves partisans, but they act like partisans. And in my research, I find they act like partisans as well. So people who say they're an independent but lean Democrat are less likely to return to religion. The reverse, the same with leaning Republicans. Those who are pure independents, I actually find, are the least religious of all the groups. And part of it might be about, you know, being on a team or being a political independent, being religiously independent. Those things also go together, that you are sort of an unaffiliated type of person. But pure independents are actually less religious than Democrats. So thinking about the gap, but remembering that the number of pure independents is actually far smaller than when what you might read in the newspaper about kind of undecideds or independents.
This may be too much in the weeds, but reading your book, I was thinking about libertarians and Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand was an atheist.
Right.
Libertarians often associate themselves with the Republican Party. Not all. Maybe independents, I'm not sure. But is there a way to think through that?
Yeah, no, it's a really tricky, because libertarians should be very uncomfortable with the religion and the public sphere. They should also be uncomfortable legislating women's bodies, right? They should just take a kind of general
hands off
approach and be very kind of a consistent small government mm-hmm. type of person. And that's a whole different level of cognitive dissonance that I actually am not prepared to answer.
Well, fair enough. But I also think all of this underscores just, you can call it hypocrisy, you can call it contradiction, you can call it dissonance, is that, you know, when it comes to politics and religion, we all operate out of our own definitions to some extent. I mean, we identify a certain kind of way, but for our own particular reasons.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also think it's worth saying, it's tricky when you live in a two-party system.
Right.
Right. You have to pick. And so what I find most interesting about evangelical support for Trump is not that evangelicals voted for him. It's that they have such high levels of approval now. Right. His levels of approval are far higher than, you know, George W. Bush, say. And so the last, you know, Republican president that we had. And so I think that's, to me, that's more interesting, because you can begrudgingly vote for someone but not be very approving. Mm. And so to me, where the question of hypocrisy or those issues come less about who you pulled the lever for and more this kind of sustained enthusiasm.
But does that get us back to abortion with now two people on the U.S. Supreme Court? And that does put Roe in some degree of risk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that people seem that, yeah, that seems to be, at least when I was talking to people in Alabama, Supreme Court seemed very important, which, you know, there is, I don't think irony is the right word, but given that it is already very difficult to get an abortion in Alabama. So the commitment to sending it back to the states when they also happen to live in a state where it's very, very difficult already mm-hmm. to get an abortion, even in your first trimester, is it says just how either committed they are or potentially misinformed about things as well.
Let me get some callers in. And again, you can call us at this phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Alex needs to just hit my computer here so that I can see the screen. Let me get Marie from Wayne to join us on Radio Times. And Marie, go ahead. You're on the air.
I consider myself the Democrat evangelical who does not subscribe to the current political climate. And I'm wondering if the author had any opportunity to try to square the budgets that many of these evangelical churches, I would say all evangelical churches, have for mission outreach, sending missionaries all around the globe, but yet have such hostility for the immigrants at our own border. I've never been able to understand that.
Maria, I just have a quick question for you. As you said, you describe yourself as a Democrat and an evangelical. We've been talking about evangelicals largely associating themselves with the Republican Party, especially if they're white. Is there a quick answer to why you are both a Democrat and an evangelical?
Because I believe in the golden rule, and I don't think that the current political climate does unto others as we would have others do unto ourselves.
That's a very concise answer. I appreciate the call. Let me see what our guest has to say. Michelle, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that this is really interesting. I mean, what's fascinating about missionary work is how the evangelical, it is part of the mission, right? To go forth and whether it's evangelize or help others and bring others to Christ. And that doesn't seem to be happening at the border. And to the extent that I talk to regular people in Alabama, it seemed like they were sympathetic to that, and that was the one area where they weren't super supportive of what Trump was doing. But they also, again, justified it by saying the immigration system's broken. We have to do something about it. And another talking point that I did hear a lot there that I had not been aware of, I don't know if it's from media that I don't consume, was this distinction, you know, that a lot of the people who are coming over the border with children, that they were not, in fact, their children.
Oh.
And that they were bringing them over, and that it's really a shame that these children were being, you know, manipulated and, used for adult gain and basically trafficked, but that they're not actually families being separated. And again, getting
I
back
think
to
the
this.
The facts would belie most of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it says something about the types of things you can and will believe in order to retain the political justification. Because if you truly thought that your political guy was separating families at the border and putting children in cages and doing everything that we've been reading about for months and months and months, that would be very difficult to square with your religious beliefs. And so it seems like there are narratives out there that help you deal with that.
Marie, thanks for the call. Let me read some more questions or comments. There's a question from Vince. Can you talk about Reagan and the Pope bringing down communism? We've been talking about largely evangelicals, but the Catholics and the Catholic Church, and certainly this particular Pope has, who's pretty political in his own way when it comes to American politics, certainly has had a role to play.
Yeah, so today's political environment is with Pope Francis is fascinating as a researcher, because here you precisely have a shift in terms of the guard as far as what types of policies and how outspoken he is. And we've seen the political consequences or the religious consequences of it, which is that Republican Catholics, particularly Republican male Catholics, have become far less supportive of Pope Francis than at the beginning of his tenure as Pope. And so again, it says something both about the power of politics, but also remembering the limitations sometimes of religion, that what might look like religious influence might really be a religious leader saying something that you already agree with. And then when you have a religious leader like Pope Francis coming in saying something to which to people who might not agree with it, some people might change their attitudes. Some people might change their attitudes toward the Pope, right, in response.
But I think for some people, politics is their religion. I mean, there is no difference between their religious beliefs and their political beliefs.
Absolutely. When I was, again, in Alabama, two different pastors talked to me about how they lost members, or they had members come and talk to them, because these were people who did not think that they should be praying for President Obama. It was a general thing that they would pray for the leader of the government every Sunday. These were people who did not have a problem with it, with the Republican predecessor. The ones that had complained about it but didn't leave the church don't seem to have a problem with it now. But the idea that your politics and religion are so linked that something that you had always done in your church, which is pray for the religious, the political leaders, which is done in churches and synagogues and mosques across the country. But when it was a Democrat and maybe a polarizing Democratic a figure, all of a sudden that's a problem. And that just says just how much your religion and politics are maybe one and the same.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So do you see, I mean, we live in a very polarizing partisan times. I think it's been said that Sunday morning is, you know, as segregated as almost any other time in America. Do you see us just drifting farther and farther apart, or do you think there are points of intersection that people can rally around?
I hope the latter. Right?
Sometimes it doesn't feel like it.
No, sometimes it doesn't feel like it. But regardless of whether you yourself are religious or not, I subscribe to the idea that religion can be used for good and it can bring people together. And normatively, we think that's a good thing. That's what we strive for. And it does seem like there are religious left organizations that are trying to become more vocal and making it clear that you can hold these beliefs politically and religiously. And I don't know if that's necessarily bringing us together so much as religious. Maybe Marie is just going to go to a different religious community to be with political like-minded people. She's not going to opt out of faith, but move to a different community altogether. So I'm not super optimistic, to be perfectly honest, but I would love to find something that can bring people together, regardless of faith or non-faith, that this should be something that can help bridge, and it seems like it's further dividing us.
When you look at the link between the Republican Party and conservative Christians, do you think for some Democrats that drives them away from religion? I mean, the things are so polarized that they see religion as kind of contaminated by party.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we see that because a lot of the people who are Democrats who have left organized religion, they either call themselves a Christian but never attend, or they just have dropped the label altogether. They're not hostile toward religion. They're not avowed atheists. They believe in God. They believe in heaven. They pray privately from time to time. These are not people who are anti-religion. They seem to be anti-American religion today as like an organized concept. But they're not necessarily, their private beliefs don't necessarily match up with that. And that says something about the strength of politics, that these aren't people who are necessarily strong atheists who no matter what the political environment is, they would just not be religious. These are people who seem to have been pushed out on account of politics, but otherwise might be involved.
Well, fascinating thing to talk about. Michelle Margolis, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called From Politics to the Pews, How Partisanship and the Political Environment Shape Religious Identity. And our guest is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Appreciate all those calls and comments to Radio Times. Seems like religion and politics gets people's juices flowing, and we like that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can also sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.